This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Only Plane in the Sky, An Oral History of 9/11 by Garrett M. Graff. Read by a full cast, with the introduction and acknowledgments read by the author. Narrated by Holter Graham.
To my daughter, Eliza, and to all the children affected by 9/11, I hope this book helps you understand the world in which you live. Author's note. Nearly every American above a certain age remembers precisely where they were on September 11th, 2001. What began as an ordinary day became the deadliest terrorist attack in world history and the deadliest attack on the United States since Pearl Harbor, shocking and terrifying the global community, exposing us to unimaginable tragedy and evil, while also reminding us of the strength, bravery, and power of the human spirit. Heroes quite literally emerged from the ashes, and the hours and decisions that followed defined not just a generation, but our modern era. All told, 2,606 people died at the World Trade Center in New York City, and another 125 at the Pentagon. 206 people died when their planes, American Airlines Flight 77, United Airlines Flight 175, American Airlines Flight 11, flight numbers now permanently retired and part of history, were hijacked and crashed into the centers of America's financial and military power. Another 40 died in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, as brave passengers and crew wrestled control of United Airlines Flight 93 back from the hijackers. The 9/11 Memorial and Museum in New York City honors a precise tally of 2,983 casualties, including six killed in 1993 when the World Trade Center was attacked for the first time by the forerunners of the terror group that would ultimately bring those buildings down in just 102 minutes 8 years later. The 9/11 victims represented not merely Americans, but citizens of more than 90 nations. The toll obviously stretched beyond the dead alone. More than 3,000 children lost a parent on 9/11. Including some 100 children who were born in the subsequent months and would never meet their fathers. Upwards of 6,000 people were injured, and many more would face injuries, some psychological, some physical, some eventually fatal, stemming from the recovery work. Far beyond the official numbers, however, the attacks affected nearly every American alive that day, and hundreds of millions, if not billions, beyond our shores, as news of the attacks was broadcast the world over. I've spent 3 years collecting the stories of those who lived through and experienced 9/11, where they were, what they remember, and how their lives changed. The book that follows is based on more than 500 oral histories, conducted by me as well as dozens of other historians and journalists over the last 17 years. I'm deeply grateful for their work and their understanding that history would want and need these stories to be recorded. Collectively, these narratives help make sense of a day that we as a country and as a people are still trying to process. In her oral history of the day, Eve Butler G., who was on 9/11 a clerk in the U.S. House of Representatives, remarked on how fascinated Americans are by their own memories of that day. I've noticed we don't listen to each other's stories. We need to tell our story. Someone will start saying, well, I was such and such, and the other person will interrupt and talk over and say, well, I was so and so. The shock, in many ways, is still embedded in our memories that this thing happened on our shores, in the places where we felt the safest. Her observation rang true to me throughout this project, as every mention of 9/11 to friends or acquaintances immediately prompted people to pour out their own stories, often with heart-wrenching intimacy. This book is an attempt to listen, to hear others' stories, to know what it was like to experience the day firsthand, to wrestle with the confusion and the terror. The Only Plane in the Sky is not meant to be a precise account of how and why September 11th occurred. Groups like the 9/11 Commission devoted years of work and millions of dollars to provide those answers. Instead, this book intends to capture how Americans lived that day, how the attacks in New York City, at the Pentagon, and in the skies over Somerset County, Pennsylvania, rippled across lives from coast to coast, from the Twin Towers to an elementary school in Sarasota, Florida, and how government and military officials on Capitol Hill, at the White House, in mountain bunkers, at air traffic control centers, and in the cockpit of fighter planes responded in an unprecedented moment to unimaginable horrors. To construct this book, I worked for 2 years with Jenny Pachucki, an oral historian who has dedicated her career to stories of September 11th, and who located for me about 5,000 relevant oral histories collected and archived around the country. We closely read or listened to about 2,000 of these stories to identify the voices and memories featured here. As part of that, I've drawn upon interviews and exhaustive work from the National September 11 Memorial and Museum and the 9/11 Tribute Museum in New York City, the Flight 93 National Memorial near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the September 11th Education Trust, the U.S. House of Representatives Historians Office, C-SPAN, the Arlington County, Virginia Public Library, the Fire Department of the City of New York, the Historical Office of the Secretary of Defense, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Coast Guard, the 9/11 Commission, the Museum of Chinese in America in New York City, Columbia University, Stony Brook University, and other repositories, as well as a host of snippets and transcripts culled from news articles, magazine profiles, pamphlets, videos, documentaries, collections ranging from the trial exhibits of 9/11 conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui to a compilation published by America Online of its users' thoughts, posts, and memories of 9/11, as well as countless other books, including three that deserve specific mention for their usefulness: Mitchell Fink and Lois Mathias's terrific 2002 collection of oral histories entitled Never Forget, as well as two books focused on the 9/11 New York Maritime Boat Lift, Mike McGee's All Available Boats, and Jessica Dulong's Dust to Deliverance. To supplement these existing archival primary sources, I've collected several hundred interviews, personal reflections, and stories myself, about 75 of which are featured here. I'm grateful to all who shared their stories. Among these hundreds of memories collected as early as September 2001 and as recently as the spring of 2019, the chronologies and stories don't always line up neatly. Perspectives differ, and images blur with time. Traumatic memories especially are fallible. I've done my best to line things up according to the facts and timelines available. All interviews have been condensed and edited for clarity. Throughout the book, all titles, occupations, locations, and ranks are accurate to that moment. Additionally, for ease of reading and historical accuracy, I've edited some quotations to make verb tenses consistent and made minor factual corrections. For instance, where a speaker misremembered a name or title, such as calling the speaker pro tem the president pro tem, or misstating what floors the sky lobbies in the World Trade Center were actually on. I've also standardized some place names, code words, and other references that would otherwise be more confusing than illuminating. While The Only Plane in the Sky is comprehensive, it is not complete. These stories capture only a single moment in time, and part of what makes 9/11 so poignant is learning how people fared in the days, weeks, months, and years thereafter. Two key players on that day, Bernard Carrick, Commissioner of the New York Police Department, and Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert, would both later end up in prison, for instance. As the nation united in solidarity after the attacks, it also descended into two wars that continue to this day and reshaped multiple corners of the world. Thus, 9/11 remains a daily presence in our national politics and our international geopolitics, and it fundamentally changed the way we live, travel, and interact with one another. As Rosemary Dillard, an American Airlines manager in D.C., whose husband Eddie was aboard one of the hijacked flights, said, "I still think that we walk on eggshells. I don't think that the young people who will be listening to this will know the same freedom I knew growing up." Today, that new generation Dillard mentions barely remembers the day itself. 2018 marked the first year military recruits born after 9/11 were deployed to war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fall of 2019 will mark the entrance of the first college class born after the attacks. That passage of time makes remembering 9/11 all the more important. Indeed, to understand all that came after, we must first understand what it was like to live through the drama and tragedy that began under the crisp, clear, blue skies of Tuesday, September 11, 2001.
Aboard the International Space Station. On August 12, 2001, NASA astronaut Frank Culbertson arrived at the International Space Station aboard the space shuttle Discovery. He would live and work aboard the space station for 125 days. On September 11, 2001, he was the only American off the planet.
Commander Frank Culbertson, astronaut, NASA. On September the 11th, 2001, I called the ground and my flight surgeon, Steve Hart, came on. I said, "Hey, Steve, how's it going?" He said, "Well, Frank, we're not having a very good day down here on Earth." He began to describe to me what was happening in New York. The airplanes flown into the World Trade Center. Another airplane flown into the Pentagon. He said, "We just lost another airplane somewhere in Pennsylvania. You don't know where or what's happening." I looked at the laptop that has our world map on it, and I saw that we were coming across southern Canada. In a minute, we were going to be over New England. I raced around, found a video camera, and a window facing in the right direction. About 400 miles away from New York City, I could clearly see the city. It was a perfect weather day all over the United States, and the only activity I could see was this big black column of smoke coming out of New York City out over Long Island and over the Atlantic. As I zoomed in with the video camera, I saw this big gray blob basically enveloping the southern part of Manhattan. I was seeing the second tower come down. I assumed tens of thousands of people were being hurt or killed. It was horrible to see my country under attack. We had 90 minutes to set up for the next pass across the United States. We set up every camera we could. I said, "Guys, we're going to take pictures of everything we can see as we come across the U.S. An hour and a half later, we crossed Chicago. I was looking all around for any evidence of further attacks. I could see all the way to Houston. In a few minutes, we crossed Washington, D.C., directly over the Pentagon. I could look straight down and see the gash on the side of it. I could see the lights of the rescue vehicles, the smoke of the fires. Looking north, I could clearly see New York City in the column of smoke. Every orbit, we kept trying to see more of what was happening. One of the most startling effects was that within about two orbits, all the contrails normally crisscrossing the United States had disappeared because they had grounded all the airplanes and there was nobody else flying in U.S. airspace except for one airplane that was leaving a contrail from the central U.S. toward Washington. That was Air Force One heading back to D.C. with President Bush.
Good days and bad days. September 10th. Monday, September 10th in New York City began with the rededication of a Bronx firehouse, home to Engine 73 and Ladder 42. Mayor Rudolph Rudy Giuliani, Fire Commissioner Thomas Von Essen, and Chief of Department Peter Gansey listened as Fire Department Chaplain Father Michael Judge offered a homily for the renovated firehouse.
Father Michael Judge, Chaplain, FDNY. Good days and bad days. Up days, down days, sad days, happy days. But never a boring day on this job. You do what God has called you to do. You show up. You put one foot in front of another. You get on the rig, and you go out, and you do the job, which is a mystery and a surprise. You have no idea when you get on that rig, no matter how big the call, no matter how small, you have no idea what God is calling you to. But He needs you. He needs me. He needs all of us.
Across the country, Monday was a regular workday, the beginning of fall, the first full week after Labor Day, and for many communities, the first day of school after the quiet summer doldrums of August. Reporters and news broadcasters filed back into their offices, as did government officials and business professionals, bringing cities back to life. Many anticipated a slow start to the season.
Tom Brokaw, anchor NBC News. I'd been off most of the summer. A friend called up to ask how it was to be back. I said, I'm doing fine, but there's no news. It's hard to get cranked back up. It looked like it was not going to be a terribly stimulating autumn. Social Security reform was the hot topic. The economy was winding down.
Mary Matlin, aide to Vice President Dick Cheney. There was a sense of, okay, now back to business. We had economic issues at the time. We were on the front end of a recession.
Matthew Waxman, staff member, National Security Council, White House. This was an administration that was interested in great power politics. A great deal of effort was focused on U.S.-Russian arms control and the strategic relationship questions about how to manage a rising China. These were the central questions. Two possible regional crises that week we worried about were Burundi and Macedonia.
Monica O'Leary, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower, 105th floor. On September 10th in the afternoon, my guess is around 2 o'clock, I was laid off. I don't know the exact time, but I know I thought to myself, oh, I can be home in time for General Hospital. When I got laid off, I was on the 105th floor. I was upset. I was crying. Eventually, when I calmed down, the woman for HR gave me the choice. Do you want to go back to the desk and get your stuff, or do you want to go home? I said, oh, no, no, no. I want to go say goodbye to everybody. I went around and started kissing everybody goodbye. They were all great. This guy, Joe Sacerdoti, stood up in the back row and he yelled, it's their loss, Monica.
Lisbeth Glick, wife of United Flight 93 passenger Jeremy Glick. I was on maternity leave from a teaching job at Berkeley, a business college in New York. On that Monday morning, September 10th, Jeremy helped me pack up the car. He was going to California on business and was booked on a flight that night. We live in Hewitt, New Jersey, and I was going up to my parents' house in the Catskill Mountains while he was away. He packed me up, and then he headed down to Newark for a meeting. He called me at around 5 o'clock and said there had been a fire in Newark, and he didn't feel like arriving in California at 2 in the morning. He decided to go home, get a good night's sleep, and catch the first flight out Tuesday morning.
From May to October 2001, Vanessa Lawrence and Monica Bravo were supposed to be two of a total of 15 artists in residence on the 91st and 92nd floors of the World Trade Center's North Tower, as part of the Studioscape program run by the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. Both were inspired by the towers and had begun to incorporate them into their art.
Vanessa Lawrence, artist, North Tower, 91st floor. Because I was living in a basement where I just saw people's feet, I thought it would be amazing to paint from such a high view, seeing different weather patterns, changing skies, changing light.
Monica Bravo, artist, North Tower, 91st floor. The reason I applied was because I wanted to film. I had this image in my mind, the twin towers above and only clouds underneath. The thing I missed most from my native Colombia were the clouds and the mountains. We have a lot of clouds all the time, and for me, the cloud is like home.
Vanessa Lawrence. I loved that skyline. Every morning coming in, there was something special. Again, at night, seeing them lit up, just the lights on them. It was a really special skyline.
Monica Bravo. I told everybody throughout the summer, if you see something coming, a storm, let me know. I'm always going to have a camera ready. The afternoon of September 10th, around 2:55 p.m., the storms happened.
Vanessa Lawrence. I grabbed my watercolors because I could see this storm coming. It was amazing watching it way out, looking out across Brooklyn and out on the horizon. I remember watching this dark cloud going down to the ground and all the colors in it and everything. There's one of my favorite paintings I did.
Monica Bravo. I started filming. The storm was coming from New Jersey south through the Verrazano Bridge and the Statue of Liberty. You see these clouds moving very fast. And there's a moment that is really, really incredible in the film. You see one drop hitting the window. Then in a second, all these water drops hitting the window. The storm is there. It's with you.
Vanessa Lawrence. Watching it coming, 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 and then nothing. We were in this thick cloud and the rain.
Monica Bravo. The video is the witness of the last people standing. The last night before these towers ceased to exist and everything and everybody that was inside. You see people in the South Tower coming in, working. You see people alive. You can see boats going. You see the city of Brooklyn lighting up. You see the movement of the bridges. It's alive. You see the life of the city from the last night you could see it from that perspective. I filmed for many hours until 9 or 9:30 p.m. probably. The storm was very long, the whole afternoon. I filmed in different places, in time-lapse, in slow motion. It was beautiful. Then at one point my cell phone rang. I was married then and this person called me. Are you going to come home? I said, oh no, beautiful thunderstorm. I said to him, why don't you come over and bring me some cigarettes? He said, no, I'm not going to bring you anything. You come home. So I said, all right, all right. I actually took the tape out of the camera. I left my computer because it was raining a lot. I was looking for a place to put it. I found an old file cabinet made out of wood. I remember thinking, is this going to be safe? And then, this is the World Trade Center. Nothing can happen to this building.
An easy day. Tuesday begins. Around the world, September 11th began as any other weekday. Congress was re-engaging after its summer recess. In Herndon, Virginia, at the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA's National Command Center, Ben Sliney prepared for his first day running the nation's airspace. Nearby, in Langley, Virginia, Gina Haspel began her first day at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. In Washington, D.C., FBI Director Robert Mueller, who had started in his new post just 1 week earlier on September 4th, was scheduled to appear at 8 a.m. for his first briefing on the FBI's unfolding investigation of a terror group known as Al-Qaeda and its bombing of the USS Cole the previous fall. Far from America's shores, the captain of the U.S. Navy's aircraft carrier USS Enterprise was just finishing a long tour enforcing the no-fly zone over Iraq and looking forward to returning home. In New York City, it was primary day. New Yorkers would choose the candidates vying to replace the man who had run their city for 8 years, Rudy Giuliani. Millions of residents, workers, school children, and commuters awoke and began preparing for the day, many boarding trains, ferries, subways, and buses to make their way into Lower Manhattan. The FDNY's Director of Fire Education Safety was particularly excited that Tuesday. He was set to launch a new toy modeled on a New York firefighter and had chosen the day carefully. The date, after all, seemed perfect for firefighters. 911.
Lieutenant Joseph Torillo, Director of Fire Education Safety, FDNY. Fisher Price had a line of children's toys called Rescue Heroes the kids loved. They had a police officer called Jake Justice, a lifeguard called Wendy Waters, an ambulance attendant called Perry Medic. They wanted a New York City firefighter. They were going to call him Billy Blazes. They would give me $1 for every Billy Blazes sold around the world, money I would use in my public education program. They wanted to do a big press conference and introduce this new rescue hero to the world. I was scratching my head with the executives and I said, 911 is the emergency phone number in New York City. Why don't we have a 911 day in New York? So on 9/11 at 9 o'clock in the morning, every TV station in New York City was waiting for me at Rockefeller Center to introduce this new rescue hero.
Herb Ouida, World Trade Center Association, North Tower, 77th floor, and father of Todd Ouida, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower, 105th floor. As we did every morning, my son Todd and I left our home together to travel to work because Todd was working at the World Trade Center for Cantor Fitzgerald. When we got down to Hoboken, I said to Todd, "Why don't you take the ferry with me? It's a beautiful day." He said, "No, Dad, it's too cold." I told him, "Have a great day, sweetheart." Those were my last words to Todd.
Richard Eichen, consultant, Pass Consulting Group, North Tower, 90th floor. I used to take the train every day to the Trade Center. I was sitting next to a friend. We belonged to the same golf club. And we were talking about how bad the food was. That was my biggest care in the world that day.
Ted Olson, Solicitor General, U.S. Department of Justice. My wife, Barbara, was supposed to travel Monday, and my birthday was Tuesday. She decided that she was not going to go Monday. She did not want to be gone on the morning of my birthday. She wanted to be there when I woke up. I left for work early in the morning, before 6 o'clock, and she left shortly after to go to the airport. I heard from her before she boarded. This plane was scheduled to leave at 8:10 in the morning. We always called one another a lot during the day, sometimes very briefly. She called me at 7:30 or 7:40 before she got on the plane.
Rosemary Dillard, base manager, American Airlines. My husband Eddie had just acquired a house in LA and was going out to work on the house to get it in order so he could rent or sell it. We were driving out to Dulles because Flight 77 was nonstop to LA, and we were laughing. I remember him getting out, and he reminded me, "Before you go to work, get gas." He kissed me. My last words to him were, "Be home by Thursday."
Laura Bush, First Lady of the United States, White House. I'd spent most of the morning going over the briefing that I was supposed to give that day to the Senate Education Committee. I was giving a briefing on the results from a summit that I'd had earlier in the summer on early childhood education. It was about 9 months into George being president, and I was really hitting my stride as First Lady.
Ada Dulch, Principal, High School for Leadership and Public Service, HSLPS, New York City. It was primary election day. Our school building was going to be used for the very first time as a voting site.
Fernando Ferrer, Bronx Borough President and candidate for New York City Mayor. Hard primary campaign. My wife and I went to vote. It was all very nice, and our tracking polls gave me reason to be in a very good mood that day.
Sonny Mindell, Communications Director for the Mayor of the City of New York, Rudy Giuliani. On September 11th, I was facing what I thought would be an easy day.
William Jimeno, Officer, Port Authority Police Department. I remember waking up and making a decision. I'm a big bow hunter. I like to deer hunt, and the weather was going to be great. I was going to possibly take a P-Day, which is a personal day at the Port Authority Police. I said, no, I'm going to save it for a later time.
The storm of September 10th that swept across the Northeast, marking the passage of a strong cold front, preceded a high-pressure system of dry Canadian air that gave rise to a unique and memorable meteorological phenomenon known as severe clear. Cloudless skies that made an enduring impression on all who would witness what transpired in the hours ahead.
Ben Sliney, National Operations Manager, FAA Command Center, Herndon, Virginia. That was my first day on the job as National Operations Manager. When I got up that morning and looked at the weather channel and saw that the entire East Coast was going to be severe clear, I anticipated it would be a pretty good first day.
Melinda Murphy, Traffic Reporter, WPIX-TV, New York City. We would fly for the morning show from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I had 14 hits a morning. People still remember me as the chopper chick. The sunrise that morning was incredible. We actually commented about how gorgeous the World Trade Center towers looked, reflecting this red sunrise, this crimson, gorgeous reflection like you've never seen.
Vanessa Lawrence, artist, North Tower, 91st floor. I was getting to the World Trade Center at 6 o'clock. The sun started coming up. I remember a beautiful sunrise. Walking in, you could see the red coming up through the windows.
Katie Couric, anchor, The Today Show. It was the perfect fall day. A little touch of autumn in the air. It was one of those back-to-school September days full of possibilities and, in its own way, a new beginning.
Bruno Dellinger, Principal, Quintamassis, North America, North Tower, 47th floor. The sky was so pure. The air was so crisp. Everything was perfect.
It's like the air was scrubbed clean.
Richard Payden, Trooper, Aviation Unit, Pennsylvania State Police. A really nice morning, weather-wise. As pilots, we say clear blue and 22 when it's blue skies and not a cloud in the sky.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Duffy, F-15 pilot, Otis Air Force Base, Cape Cod, Massachusetts. One of the prettiest days I've ever flown. Literally, there was not a cloud in the sky, and visibility was probably better than 100 miles. It was crystal clear.
One of the most beautiful days of the year.
There has never been as brilliant of a blue sky as there was that day.
The sky was extraordinarily blue.
A gorgeous blue.
So blue.
Deep blue.
Deep, deep blue.
Cobalt blue.
Cerulean blue.
The bluest of blues.
Julia Rogers, Page, U.S. House of Representatives. One of those days that you wish you could put in a bottle.
President George W. Bush began his morning in Sarasota, Florida, where he was set to read to elementary school students as part of his push for the No Child Left Behind legislation. His new administration was still finding its legs after a rocky transition period shortened by the bitter Bush v. Gore Florida recount and the controversial Supreme Court decision that declared him the winner of the 2000 election. A decision many still disputed in September 2001.
Gordon Jandro, Assistant Press Secretary, White House. The day started off very normally. The president went for a run, and I took the press pool out with the president. I remember I got stung by a bee, and I asked White House physician Dr. Richard Tubb if he had something he could give me for the swelling. He said, "Yeah, we'll get you something when we get to the airplane."
Sonia Ross, reporter, Associated Press. It was a garden variety trip. It was low-ranking staff, and a lot of the top journalists didn't come. It was a scrub trip.
Mike Morrell, Presidential Briefer, Central Intelligence Agency. I walked into his suite for the president's morning intelligence briefing. He was surrounded by breakfast foods and hadn't touched any of it. The Second Intifada was well underway then, and the briefings at that time were very heavy on Israeli-Palestinian stuff. There was nothing in the briefing about terrorism. It was very routine.
Andy Card, White House Chief of Staff. The president was in a great mood. He had that George W. Bush strut that morning.
B. Alexander Sandy Kress, Senior Education Advisor, White House. Those were probably the last carefree moments he had in his term.
Andy Card. I remember literally telling him, it should be an easy day. Those were the words, it should be an easy day.
You'll miss your plane. Checking in. As America's day began, two men arrived for their early morning connection to Boston at the Portland International Jetport in Portland, Maine. They checked in at 5:43 a.m. Over the course of the morning, 17 men checked into their flights at Boston's Logan International, Washington's Dulles International, and Newark International. While some were selected for extra screening or had their checked bags searched, no one gave the knives they carried on board a second look. They were allowed under the security regulations at the time. The men made their way onto carefully selected cross-country flights, targeting four planes amid the nearly 40,000 domestic flights scheduled for that Tuesday.
Mike Tuohy, ticket agent, Portland International Jetport. Everybody was in a good mood. It was a gorgeous day, and things were going like clockwork.
Von Alex, ticket agent, Washington Dulles International Airport, Virginia. These two guys came running in the front door, looking around, and didn't know which way to go.
Mike Tuohy. I saw these two fellas standing there looking around. I looked at the tickets. I go, whoa, first-class tickets. You don't see $2,400 tickets anymore. There were less than 30 minutes prior to the flight when they arrived. The younger fellow was standing off to the right. I was asking the standard questions. Has anybody given you anything to carry on board the plane? Have your bags been out of your control since you packed them? He was shaking his head, smiling at me, so it's okay.
Von Alex, we just finished the morning check-in. The counter was clear. I said to the other agent, here are the passengers that are running late, but I think that we can get them on.
Mike Tuohy. I said, Mr. Atta, if you don't go now, you will miss your plane.
A really happy feeling. 8 a.m. in New York City. The World Trade Center had the two tallest buildings in New York City, iconic fixtures on the skyline for nearly 40 years. Reaching more than 1,300 feet into the sky, the 110-story twin buildings, the North Tower, known as One World Trade, and the South Tower, known as Two World Trade, anchored a 16-acre complex of seven buildings in the heart of Lower Manhattan's financial sector. Nestled between them was Three World Trade, which held a 22-story Marriott Hotel. Four other buildings surrounded the site. Four World Trade, a 9-story building occupied primarily by Deutsche Bank. Five World Trade, also a 9-story office building. Six World Trade, an 8-story building occupied by the U.S. Customs House for New York and other government agencies. And Seven World Trade, a 47-story building that included New York's Office of Emergency Management. Beneath the complex was a shopping mall that housed eateries and about 80 retail stores. The World Trade Center site was owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, a governmental agency created in 1921 that also oversees New York's airports, LaGuardia, Kennedy, and Newark, the Port Authority bus terminal in New York City, the PATH commuter train system, as well as the tunnels and bridges between the two states. It has its own Port Authority Police Department, PAPD, which in 2001 consisted of 1,331 officers, all of whom were cross-trained in basic firefighting. In July 2001, real estate mogul Larry Silverstein purchased the lease for World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, 4, and 5. As Tuesday, September 11th, 2001 began, the 50,000 people who worked across the World Trade Center complex began to arrive. Each floor of the North and South Towers represented a full acre of office space. On an average day, 70,000 visitors would pass through for meetings, shopping, a meal at the Windows on the World restaurant atop the North Tower, or to soak in views from the public observation deck atop the South Tower. For all of them, It was just another morning.
Dan Potter, firefighter, Ladder 10, FDNY. My wife worked at One World Trade Center, and she had a business engagement with other bosses on the 81st floor. I made her an asparagus omelet for breakfast, then she went to walk to work.
Jean Potter, Bank of America, North Tower, 81st floor. I would leave the house every day and say to him the last line of this movie, the story of Christ. Just remember, Jesus said, I am always with you. That's how I would leave him in the morning as I would go to work.
Dan Potter. Then I would begin my day. I was studying for the lieutenant promotion exam coming up in October. I walked across to the Trade Center. I had a pickup parked at the bottom of 2 World Trade Center. We had spaces down there provided for the firefighters assigned to 10 House, the station near the towers that housed Ladder 10 and Engine 10.
Jared Coates, Risk Waters Group, New York City. I was an employee of Risk Waters Group, which was holding the technology conference at Windows on the World on September 11th. My job that morning was to make sure all of our publications were unloaded and put on display racks. William Jimeno, Officer PAPD. It was a normal routine day. We got a little coffee, went out on post, and I remember standing, looking at the entrance of the bus terminal at 42nd and 8th Avenue, what we call the Rush. The Rush is where everybody from New Jersey, Connecticut, other parts of New York take buses into the terminal. It's a steady flow of thousands of people coming into Midtown Manhattan.
Michael Monaco, Executive Chef, Windows on the World, North Tower, 106th floor. My usual hours were from 8:30 in the morning until 10, 10:30 at night. That morning, my wife and I got up a little bit early because we were voting in the primaries. There was no one at the polls. It wasn't that busy. My reading glasses were in need of repair. When I hit the street in front of Tower 2, I thought, wow, it's really early. It's not even 8:15. I bet I can get the optometrist to see me and I can have my glasses this afternoon. I made a detour to the Trade Center concourse level and I went straight for lens grafters. A minute later, I was standing at the counter asking, I need new lenses for my glasses.
Judith Wine, Senior Vice President, Aon Corporation, South Tower, 103rd floor. My husband and I, we got off the bus right when it got to Pearl and Frankfurt. We would walk up the block, following the Brooklyn Bridge coming down, and at City Hall Park, we would say goodbye. He would go to his place, and I would walk down to the Trade Center. The weather was so nice. He had a really happy feeling. I turned and smiled to him. He said later that stuck in his mind, because for hours he didn't know whether I was alive or not.
Vanessa Lawrence. I was hesitant to go make this phone call to my friend Amelia, who was coming to see the studio. I thought, I need a break. About 8:30, I went down. You came down the elevator and then through a door to use the payphone. I called her. I went and got a juice. Coming back, one of the security guards started chatting to me. How are you doing? I'm like, good, good. I was so anxious to get back up and paint. It's like, gotta go, and walked on the elevator, went up.
Richard Eichen. You got in the elevators and went up to the 78th floor, the Sky Lobby. Then you had to go to another elevator bank, and then get up to the 90th floor. The elevator going up to 78 was so fast, you could actually feel it, and your ears would pop.
David Crivet, bond broker, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. The offices were on the 105th floor. It took about 5-10 minutes just to go upstairs. 2 elevator rides up. But when you got up top, the views were spectacular. You could see the world.
Jared Coates. I got up to the 106th floor and was greeted by some of my colleagues. Paul Bristow walked up to me and said, Jared, I was here early. I saw the magazines, so I pulled them out of the boxes and set them up on a display rack. Is this what you wanted? I said, yeah, this is great. Paul, thanks very much. If Paul hadn't been there early and set up the magazines, I probably would have still been there when the plane hit. Then I realized of all the things that had arrived, we were missing one of our titles. I offered to go back to our office and pick up some copies. I bid farewell to everyone and thought I would see them in an hour or less. I headed down the elevator. The elevator stopped at the floor below the Windows on the World. It was Cantor Fitzgerald's office. One gentleman got on the elevator, another stood there in the hallway discussing something with him. I'll never forget his face.
Dan Potter. I drove over to Staten Island. I remember going into the American Legion Hall. You got your study material for the lieutenant's exam, and then you went and sat at a desk. You had an hour to do usually 50 questions.
Joe Massian, technology consultant, Port Authority, North Tower. I was working on floor 70. I remember sitting at my desk for a minute with my backpack on. After about 5 or 10 minutes, this is probably about 8:30 a.m., I decided to take my backpack off and lay it on my desk.
David Cravette. I had a meeting at 8 o'clock. They're running late. At 8:40, I get a call from the ground floor lobby. Your visitors are here. One of the guys came without a wallet, no idea at all. Someone had to go down and sign for him. There was a girl who sat behind me, a desk assistant, who was very helpful, but she was 8.5 months pregnant. I said to myself, I'm not going to make her go down. I went downstairs. I see my client. I go, which one of you knuckleheads forgot your ID?
Joseph Lott was scheduled to speak at the Risk Waters Conference at Windows on the World. He spent the night of the 10th at the Marriott Hotel between the two towers, known as 3 World Trade Center.
Joseph Lott, sales representative, Compaq Computers. The shirt I was going to wear, a white shirt, was pretty wrinkled from laying in the suitcase, so I put on a green shirt. I went down to breakfast. My colleague Elaine Greenberg was there. We sat and had breakfast, and we went over some changes to the slides. She said that she had gone to a vacation home in Massachusetts, and while she was there, she saw a tie and bought it for me. It was a stunning tie. I said, this is such a nice gesture, I'm going to put this on. She said, well, not with that shirt. You're not going to put on a red and blue tie with a green shirt. As we left the restaurant at the Marriott, I said, I'm going to go back and change and put on that white shirt. It will look better with this tie. Go on ahead without me. I set up an ironing board and ironed the white shirt. I put that shirt on with my new tie. As I was waiting to go from the 7th floor back down to the lobby, I felt a sudden movement in the building.
Jared Coates. I walked into the office and called my London colleagues to let them know that everything but one box had arrived. I could see the time was 8:46. I remember thinking, gee, I have plenty of time to get back downtown before the event starts. I was talking to one of my colleagues in London when I heard the plane go over.
We have some planes. The hijackings. The drama of September 11th began not in New York, but in the skies over Massachusetts. That morning, 92 people, 11 crew, joined by 81 passengers, boarded American Airlines Flight 11, scheduled to fly nonstop from Boston's Logan Airport to Los Angeles International Airport. At 7:59 a.m., its pilot, Captain John Oganowski, accelerated down the runway and launched his Boeing 767 into the sky. Among the 81 passengers were 5 men set on ensuring Flight 11 never made it to its destination. 16 minutes later, on another Logan runway, Captain Victor Saracini also accelerated his plane, United Airlines Flight 175, another Boeing 767, scheduled nonstop to Los Angeles. He and First Officer Michael Horrocks were carrying a light load that day, just 65 people, 9 crew, and 56 passengers, including, again, 5 hijackers. Over the next 32 minutes, both planes were hijacked and flown toward New York, confusing air traffic controllers. 8:09 a.m. The final routine transmission from American Airlines Flight 11 came just 10 minutes into its flight. AA-11.
Good morning, American 11 with you, passing through 190 to 230.
Boston Sector.
American 11, Boston, center, Roger, climb, maintain level 280.
8:13 a.m. Shortly after American Airlines Flight 11 made its final normal transmission, it ceased responding to air traffic control. Garbled radio messages and frantic telephone calls from passengers and crew spread word of the drama above.
American 11, turn 20 degrees, right?
20 right, American 11.
American 11, climb maintain for level 350. American 11, climb maintain for level 350.
American 11, Boston.
American 11, the American on the frequency, how do you hear me? American 11, if you hear Boston Center, ident.
8:19 a.m. About 20 minutes after takeoff, and just minutes after the hijacking, Betty Ong, a 45-year-old flight attendant aboard American Airlines Flight 11, used an in-seat AT&T airphone to call the airline's reservations line, reaching agent Winston Sadler at American's Southeastern Reservations Office in Cary, North Carolina. The call would last 25 minutes. Ong had chosen to fly on Flight 11 that day so she could meet her sister to plan their trip to Hawaii for the following week. Betty Ong.
The cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class. And I think there's mates that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
Winston Sadler.
Which flight are you on?
Flight 12.
In her panic, Ong gave the wrong flight number.
And what seat are you in? Ma'am, are you there?
Yes.
What seat are you in?
Ma'am, what seat are you in? We just left Boston. We're up in the air.
I know.
We're supposed to go to L.A., and the cockpit's not answering their phone.
Okay, but what seat are you sitting in? What's the number of your seat?
Okay, I'm in my jump seat right now.
Okay.
At 3R.
Okay, you're the flight attendant? I'm sorry, did you say you're the flight attendant?
Hello?
Yes, okay. Hello? What is your name?
Hi. I'm going to have to speak up. I can't hear you.
Sure. What is your name?
Okay, my name is Betty Ong. I'm number 3 on flight 11.
Okay.
And the cockpit is not answering their phone.
And there's somebody stabbed in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. Somebody's got mace or something.
Can you describe the person that you said someone is what in business class?
I'm sitting in the back. Somebody's coming back from business. If you can hold on for 1 second, sure. They're coming back.
Unidentified flight attendant.
I don't know, but Karen and we got stabbed.
Okay. Our number one is got stabbed. Our person is stabbed. Nobody knows who stabbed who, and we can't even get up to business class right now because nobody can breathe. Our number one is stabbed right now.
Okay.
Number 5, our first class passengers, our first class galley flight attendant and our purser's been stabbed. And we can't get the cockpit. The door won't open. Hello?
Yeah, I'm taking down all the information. We're also, of course, recording this. At this point...
Realizing the severity of the situation, Sadler then followed protocol and patched the call from Flight 11 into American Airlines operations agent Nydia Gonzalez, connecting the three of them together. Nydia Gonzalez.
This is operations. What flight number are we talking about?
Flight 12.
Flight 12. Okay, I'm going on Flight 11 right now. This is Flight 11.
It's Flight 11. I'm sorry, Nydia.
Boston to Los Angeles.
Yes.
Our number one has been stabbed, and our 5 has been stabbed. Can anybody get up to the cockpit? Okay, we can't even get into the cockpit. We don't know who's up there.
Well, if they were shrewd, they would keep the door closed and...
I'm sorry?
Would they not maintain a sterile cockpit?
I think the guys are up there. They might have gone down their way up there or something. Nobody can call the cockpit. We can't even get inside.
Okay.
still there?
Yes, we're still here.
Okay. I'm staying on the line as well.
Okay.
8:21 a.m. While Winston Sadler stayed on the line with Betty Ong, Nydia Gonzalez used a second line to call American Airlines Systems Operations Center, where she reached manager Craig Marquis and relayed word of the hijacking. The recording of this second telephone call with Marquis does not capture Ong's side of the conversation, where she relayed additional information to Gonzalez. Craig Marquis.
American Airlines emergency line, please state your emergency.
Hey, this is Nitty at American Airlines calling. I am monitoring a call in which Flight 11, the flight attendant is advising our reps that the pilot, everyone's been stabbed.
Flight 11?
Yep. They can't get into the cockpit is what I'm hearing.
Okay. I'm assuming they've declared an emergency. Let me get ATC on here. Stand by.
Okay.
Anything else from this flight attendant?
So far what I've got, the number 5 flight attendant's been stabbed, but she seems to be breathing. The number 1 seems to be stabbed pretty badly, and she's lying down on the floor. They don't know whether she's conscious or not. The other flight attendants are in the back, and that's as far as I know. It seems like the passengers and the coach might not be aware of what's going on right now.
These 2 passengers were from first class?
Okay, hold on. Hey, Betty? Do you know any information as far as the gents and men that are in the cockpit with the pilots? Were they from first class? They were sitting in 2A and B. They are in the cockpit with the pilots.
Who's helping them? Is there a doctor on board?
Is there a doctor on board, Betty, that's helping you guys? You don't have any doctors on board, okay. So you've gotten all the first class passengers out of first class?
Have they taken everyone out of first class?
Yeah, she's just saying that they have. They're in coach. What's going on, honey? Okay, the aircraft is erratic again. Robbing very radically. She did say that all the first class passengers have been moved back to coach. So first class, the cabin is empty. What's going on your end, Craig?
We contacted air traffic control. They are going to handle this as a confirmed hijacking. So they're moving all the traffic out of this aircraft's way.
Okay.
He turned his transponder off, so we don't have a definitive altitude for him. We're just going by, they seem to think that they have him on a primary radar, they seem to think that he is descending.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, Lydia?
Yes, dear, I'm here.
Okay. I have the dispatcher currently taking the current fuel on board.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to run some profiles.
Okay.
To see exactly what his endurance is.
Okay.
Did you...
She doesn't have an idea who the other passenger might be in first. Apparently, they might have spread something, so it's they're having a hard time breathing or getting in that area. What's going on, Betty? Betty, talk to me. Betty, are you there? Betty? Winston, do you think you lost her? Okay, so we'll stay open. I think we might have lost her.
8:24 a.m. Back in Boston, air traffic controllers received what appeared to be a call from Flight 11, as the cockpit microphone was keyed 3 times. They later realized that the hijackers apparently had tried to speak over the intercom to the passengers on board, but instead used the air traffic control frequency. Boston Sector.
Is that American 11 trying to call?
Mohammed Atta, hijacker.
Buddy, we have some planes, just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We're turning to the airport.
15 Southwest, the phone is going to Hampton, Clemson.
And who's trying to call me here? American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll injure yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet.
Following the confusing radio call, air traffic controllers conferred among themselves to figure out what was transpiring. Boston Air Traffic Control contacted other controllers who oversaw planes at higher altitudes, a post known as Athens 38, who might have had radio contact with Flight 11. Unknown Boston Air Traffic Controller.
Hey, 38.
Athens, Sector 38.
Yes. Have you guys heard anything from American?
No.
Okay, we think there might be somebody in the cockpit right now taking it over.
8:33 a.m. Mohammed Atta, to passengers aboard Flight 11.
Nobody move, please. We're going back to the airport. Don't try to make any stupid moves.
8:33 a.m. Fearing the worst, air traffic controllers asked for local fighter aircraft to intercept and escort the flight, the standard protocol at the time for hijackings. Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Air Traffic Control.
Approach.
Dan Bueno, Air Traffic Control, Boston Sector.
Hey, Cape, Dan Bueno calling from Washington. I have a situation with American 11, a possible hijack.
American 11?
Yes, sir, departed Boston, going to LAX. Right now, he's out to Albany. I'd like to scramble some fighters to go tail him.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll talk to others here.
At 8:34 a.m., Nydia Gonzalez told Marquis about a possible fatality on the flight, explaining that one of the passengers had been stabbed. 8:37 a.m. Still not fully understanding the situation aboard American Airlines 11, but realizing it was grave, FAA Boston Center alerted a military unit known as the Northeast Air Defense Sector, NEADS, part of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD. That morning, NORAD had scheduled its biggest annual exercise, a scenario aimed at repelling a Russian nuclear attack that added to the confusion as military bases and commanders across the country struggled to comprehend what was real and what was part of the exercise. Joseph Cooper, Air Traffic Control, Boston Center.
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York. And we need you guys we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Sergeant Jeremy Powell, Northeast Air Defense Sector, NEADS, Rome, New York.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise, not a test.
8:38 a.m. Air traffic control called United Flight 175, the other Boston to Los Angeles flight, which had taken off at 8:15 a.m. and was a few miles behind American Airlines Flight 11, to warn it about the hijacking. The flight crew responded normally. New York Center.
Okay, United 175, you have much at 12 o'clock now, 5-10 miles.
United Airlines Flight 175.
Affirmative, we have him. He looks about 28,000.
Okay, thank you. United 175, 30 degrees to the right. I want you to keep you away from this traffic.
30 degrees to the right, United 175, have it.
8:40 a.m. Shortly after, NEADS called Otis Air Force Base on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and ordered two alert pilots to scramble to intercept American Airlines Flight 11. Sergeant Jeremy Powell, Northeast Air Defense Sector, NEADS, Rome, New York.
This is Huntress placing Panta 4546 on battle stations. I repeat, battle stations. Time 1241.
12:41 Greenwich Mean Time, 8:41 a.m. Eastern Time.
Authenticate. Hotel Romeo. All parties acknowledged with initials. Command post.
8:44 a.m. American Airlines flight attendant Madeline Amy Sweeney, aboard the hijacked plane, placed another telephone call back to the airline's base at Logan Airport. She spoke there with American Airlines flight service manager Michael Woodward and explained how her flight had been hijacked and how one of the passengers in business class and two of the flight attendants had been stabbed. She said, "There is a bomb in the cockpit. I can't make contact with the cockpit. Can you do it? We have paged for a doctor or nurse for the flight attendants. The coach passengers don't know what's happening." Then, as the phone call continued, the plane neared New York City, and she realized they were in trouble. In the final moments of the call, she warned, "It's a rapid descent. Something is wrong. I don't think the captain is in control. I see water. I see buildings. We're flying low. We're flying very, very low. Dash marks in a pile of clutter. Inside air traffic control. As the hijackings began on the East Coast, civilian air traffic controllers at the FAA struggled to comprehend the sudden and unprecedented threat to the 4,000 airplanes still in the air. As they rushed to contact and scramble fighter aircraft from Otis Air Force Base in Massachusetts and Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, military units in charge of the nation's air defense confronted a threat they'd never imagined, an attack coming not from outside the U.S., but from within its own borders. A decade after the end of the Cold War, they found the tools at their disposal scattered and insufficient. Caught off guard, they improvised a response. After American Airlines Flight 11 initially checked in with air traffic controller Peter Zalewski, the first warning that something had happened in the air came when the pilots ceased to respond to radio calls.
Peter Zalewski, air traffic controller, Boston Center, Nashua, New Hampshire. When American Airlines Flight 11 came to me, the pilot said, "Boston Center, this is American 11, climbing to flight level 230. I called him many, many times. "American 11, how do you hear? American 11, this is Boston Center, do you hear me? I'm calling and calling, and I'm like, my God, maybe they're drinking Dunkin' Donuts coffee up there. Honestly, that's what I was thinking. Then there's these transmissions. The first transmission from the aircraft, it's garbled to me. I don't understand it. Then there was a second one, a voice. I remember him saying, "Nobody move, please. We're going back to the airport." I will never forget that feeling up the back of my neck. It was like this adrenaline or something. I felt fear. I'm like, oh my God, the plane's being hijacked.
Colin Scoggins, airspace and procedures specialist and military specialist, FAA Boston Center. I came in at about 8:25 in the morning, and as soon as I walked to the front door, someone came to me and said there was a hijack going on. We'd worked hijacks in the past, and they were usually uneventful.
Peter Zalewski. I yell at the supervisor, "John, get over here, this plane is being hijacked, absolutely." I go, "It's Middle Eastern voices, positive." I could tell by the second time. I was used to working Egypt Air, Saudi, Turkish, all of them. It's Middle Eastern voices.
Colin Scoggins. Muhammad Atta, the pilot on American 11, the lead terrorist, stated something about more planes, that they had more planes. It was definitely plural. That's when things really started to ramp up.
Ben Sliney. I was the National Operations Manager on 9/11. That is a position located in the Washington area that has overarching authority over the nation's airspace. That was my charge, the safe and efficient operation of the nation's airspace.
Colonel Bob Marr, Commander, Needs, Rome, New York. There was a huddle of people around one of the radar scopes. I saw that huddle and thought, there's got to be something wrong.
Major General Larry Arnold, Commander of the 1st Air Force, NORAD, Tyndall Air Force Base, Florida. We had a major North American air defense exercise that morning, a command post exercise. There was a team of people that introduced scenarios that you have to react to and respond to. As we were winding up the exercise briefing, my executive officer, Lieutenant Colonel Kelly Duckett, handed me a slip of paper. Bob Marr had called and said there was a hijacking in the Boston Center area.
Ben Sliney, my experience with hijackings and our protocol was that we cooperate.
Lieutenant Colonel Don Deskins, Mission Crew Commander, Needs, Rome, New York. At this point, our mindset was the 1970s vintage hijack. We didn't have a huge concern this aircraft was going to crash.
Major General Larry Arnold. I said, "Bob, go ahead and scramble the aircraft."
Major Joe McGrady, F-15 pilot, Otis Air Force Base, Cape Cod, Massachusetts. A scramble order was issued. I ran to our jets. I started up. We realized we did not have any weapons. They filled up our jets with gas. Even though we were Winchester, which means we had no weapons, we took off.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Duffy. When we took off, I left it in full afterburner the whole time. We were supersonic going down to Long Island, and my wingman, Nasty, Major Dan Nash, called and said, "Hey, Duff, you're super." And I said, "Yeah, I know. Don't worry about it." I wanted to get there.
Colonel Bob Marr. At Mach 1, it would take them 16 minutes to get there. That's 10 miles a minute.
Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Nisipany, Mission Crew Commander, Needs, Rome, New York. Almost simultaneously, we brought in more surveillance technicians to look at the scope.
Staff Sergeant Larry Thornton, Needs. The area was so congested, the hijacked flight was incredibly difficult to find. We were looking for little dash marks and a pile of clutter on a two-dimensional scope.
Master Sergeant Joe McCain, Needs. We picked up a search track going down the Hudson Valley, straight in from the north toward New York. The plane was fast and heading in an unusual direction with no beacon, transponder. We watched that track until it faded over New York City.
Lieutenant General Tom Keck, Commander, Barksdale Air Force Base, Shreveport, Louisiana. We were in the midst of this big annual exercise called Global Guardian. They loaded all the bombers, put the submarines out to sea, put the ICBMs at nearly 100%. It was routine. You did it every year. A captain said, "Sir, we had an aircraft hit the World Trade Center." I started to correct him, saying, "When you have an exercise input, you have to start by saying, 'I have an exercise input.' That way it doesn't get confused with the real world." Then he pointed me to the TV screens in the command center. You could see smoke pouring out of the building. Like everyone else in aviation that day, I thought, how in a clear and a million day could someone hit the World Trade Center?
This will be the worst day of our lives. The first plane. At 8:46 a.m., American Airlines Flight 11 roared south through the sky over Manhattan, traversing the length of the island, surprising citygoers before it crashed into the North Tower, known as One World Trade Center, at about 465 miles per hour.
William Jimeno, Officer PAPD at the Port Authority Bus Terminal. A shadow came over 42nd and 8th Avenue. It completely covered the street for a split second.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer, Battalion 1, FTMY. In Manhattan, you rarely hear planes because of the tall buildings. We all looked up, in almost disbelief. We saw the plane pass, and it was flying so low. Our eyes followed it as it passed behind the buildings, and then it reappeared. It aimed right into the building.
Juana Lomi, paramedic, New York Beekman Downtown Hospital. I was standing outside, and I heard a rumbling sound. It sounded like a truck, but it was too loud.
Kathy Pavlik, Administrator, Port Authority, North Tower. I worked in One World Trade Center on the 67th floor. I had a window office that faced north. I glanced out the window and I saw the plane. It was a little bit over to my right and I noticed that it was very low. I had worked in the World Trade Center since before it had officially opened and we'd seen a million things over the years. As I watched, the plane got closer and closer and closer. I was in complete disbelief.
Bruno Dellinger. Everybody's heard plane engines, except very few people have heard the sound of plane engines when they're at full strength, full force, flying up in the sky. That is a horrifying sound. I still remember it very clearly. The sound of the engines flying at full force toward the World Trade Center.
Kathy Pavlik. I watched the fuselage disappear into the building.
Ian Oldaker, Staff, Ellis Island. At 9 a.m. every morning was the first staff boat from Battery Park over to Ellis Island. I stopped at Aubon Pan and got a croissant. I was continuing down Broadway. Then I heard the largest pop. I turned around and I saw glass. Lots of glass in the sky. It was really bright out. And it was reflecting off the glass and the sky, light shimmering everywhere.
NYPD Sergeant Mike McGovern was with Chief of Department Joseph Esposito just pulling into one police plaza, the department headquarters, a few blocks from the World Trade Center.
Sergeant Mike McGovern, aide to the chief, NYPD. We heard a tremendous explosion or bang. We thought it was something above us because we were directly under the Brooklyn Bridge. We pulled up to the checkpoint of police headquarters, and there was a cop manning his post. We find out after the fact this particular cop, Pete Crane, was a pilot. He said into the radio, "Central, be advised that a 767 just struck the North Tower of the World Trade Center." Chief Joe jumped out of the car and he said, "What did you say?"
Joe Esposito, Chief of Department, NYPD. I said, "How did you know it was a 767? He said, "I'm a pilot." I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "I saw." I said, "Okay."
Sergeant Mike McGovern. We turned the car around and went.
Peter Johansson, Director of Operations, New York Waterways Ferries. Honestly, I think most people felt it was a navigation accident. The reason I say that is our ferry continued around to Pier 11, the Wall Street terminal, and there were about 100 people on board. Every single one of them got off and went to work that morning. And as they're walking off, there are envelopes and letters floating down from the sky.
Ryan Conley, resident, Lower Manhattan. It looked like a ticker tape parade.
Chief Joseph Pfeiffer. I told everybody to get in the rigs because we were going down there. I picked up the department radio and told them a plane hit the World Trade Center and to transmit a second alarm. That was done immediately. That was the first official report.
Jared Coates, Risk Waters Group. One of my friends came out of an office yelling, "Which building is the conference in?" I thought, "Gee, what are you so excited about? You've got plenty of time to get down there." I yelled, "It's One World Trade Center." He replied, no, which building is it? Is it the one with the tower on it?" I walked down to the south side of my office and looked out to verify that it was the tower with the radio tower. At that moment, I realized something terrible had happened. I saw a large gaping hole in the sky full of what could only be described as confetti. Millions of sheets of white paper, floating like confetti in the sky, floating east from the World Trade Center.
Ian Oldiger. I heard the fire engines. I went east to see what was going on back there. It was much more exciting than eating my croissant.
Flight 11 hit between the 93rd and 99th floors, exploding 10,000 gallons of jet fuel into the offices of the investment firm Fred Alger Management on the 93rd floor and Marsh & McLennan, which occupied floors 93 up to 100. At Fred Alger Management, 35 people died. At Marsh & McLennan, 295. The crash immediately destroyed all exits from the floors above, leaving trapped 702 employees and visitors at the bond trader Cantor Fitzgerald on the top floors, from 100 to 105. All of the employees, conference-goers, and diners on the 106th and 107th floors at Windows on the World, as well as one engineer for NBC, William Steckman, working on the 110th floor to operate the broadcast antenna that topped the tower. The crash released a jet fuel-based fireball that shot down at least one elevator shaft and exploded through the lower floors and the tower's West Street lobby. Thick black smoke engulfed the upper floors, and light northwest winds carried the smoke over the roof of the South Tower.
Robert Leader, Executive, SMW Trading Company, North Tower. Our office was on the 85th floor. I was looking out the window, facing the Empire State Building, when I saw the plane come into the building. There was such a dramatic change of atmospheric pressure. The building swayed from the impact, and it nearly knocked me off my chair. Our ceiling imploded. Some of our walls began to implode.
Richard Eichen. I'm one of five survivors from the 90th floor of the North Tower. I didn't have the key to my office, and that's what saved my life. I was waiting outside, reading the Times, a section on Dell computers, the random things that you remember. Leaning against the wall, with my briefcase, my coffee cup on the floor, eating a bagel, waiting for these guys.